from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Philip Choi grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown, and he went on to become an architect in the Bay Area. His new book, San Francisco Chinatown, reveals the culture and history of the district and highlights landmarks like the distinctive YWCA Residence Club, which was designed by architect Julia Morgan, and Willy Wonka Playground, named after a former USF basketball star. What's your favorite Chinatown building or historic site? Join us for Forum's next hour, coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Retired architect and Chinese-American historian Philip Choi joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. In addition to co-teaching the first college-level course in Chinese-American history at San Francisco State University, he has created and consulted on a number of television documentaries and exhibits over the years and served on the California State Historic Resource Commission, the San Francisco Landmark Advisory Board, and five times as president of the Chinese Historical Society of America. A recipient of the San Francisco State President's Medal, he's recently published a book called San Francisco Chinatown, A Guide to Its History and Architecture, with architectural photos by his son, Brian Choi. Philip Choi joins us for this Forum Hour. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning. We should mention, by the way, that the oldest San Francisco ethnic neighborhood is, as probably many of you know, Chinatown. And Philip Choi, main port for Chinese immigration, first immigrant arrived here in 1848, right? That's even before Sutter's Mill.
Right.
So even before gold was discovered, the Chinese were here. Let me go back with you to that early period, first of all, before we talk about the architecture and some of the other things that that your book brings to our attention. You talk about a tour of Chinatown, and you begin with Portsmouth Square, Portsmouth Plaza, excuse me. That's where the origins really are, aren't they?
Absolutely. That's the beginning of San Francisco itself, and people don't realize that today it's a major part of Chinatown, and you see all the Chinese sitting there playing games and so on, sunning themselves, but very few people recognize and appreciate the fact that this is where San Francisco actually began.
And help me with the pronunciation. This is Dai Fo?
Dai Fo. This Dai Fo. Would be in Cantonese, Dai Fo.
Big city. That was what San Francisco was known as.
The grand city, right.
And Felicia Lowe, whom I'm sure you know, who did a big documentary on Chinatown, said this was really kind of a fortress for the Chinese in the early years. She describes it as their own world, really.
I would say that in the early days, and it depends on which period. I think by the 1870, it was definitely Chinatown. It was recognized as that.
But what a lot of people probably don't know is that the Board of Supervisors, right after the earthquake, tried to remove the Chinese from what is now Chinatown. Essentially, that area was by the financial district, so it was very valuable.
Yes, and actually it wasn't just that property was valuable. It's actually there was a very negative attitude towards the presence of the Chinese. And that was a time and excuse to remove the Chinese from San Francisco itself.
You're talking about a lot of nativism and the Chinese Exclusion Act pretty much, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. That's part of our history.
But also, I mean, the idea of moving Chinatown and moving it to Hunter's Point, I believe, because of the land being more valuable and the city fathers not wanting Chinatown where it was, suddenly the Chinese who were there came up with this idea. They would make it a valuable tourist place. So you have all these pagodas and all this architecture, which really isn't, it's kind of cooked up by American or Anglo-American architects.
Well, what I try to point out is the ethnic identity, as you see it, is not so much as for trying to be, to show that this was Chinatown, but it was rather a direct response to the hostility of the city itself. And then the merchants were deciding, well, you know, let's change that image. And even before the earthquake, this was in the plans. And surprisingly, at the same time, the city had hired Daniel Burnham of Chicago to revitalize and replan the whole city itself. And I often wonder, in fact, how did they, Burnham, plan or thought about the neighborhoods of San Francisco? How did he plan for it? As I try to look at some of the previous drawings at that time, I don't see Chinatown anywhere. So maybe.
Well, it's kind of a Disneyland that they cooked up, isn't it, really? I mean, it's a stage set and fairy type of palaces and those sorts of things.
Well, I call the architecture after the earthquake sort of Disneyland like the architects at the time didn't have any understanding of Chinese architecture per se. And so what comes to mind is all the stereotypical images. You have to remember at the time the architects were the discipline was all from Europe, and the training and all that focus from European architecture. So Chinese architecture at the time was synonymous with the political status of China. It was inferior, and everything was about Chinese and was considered inferior at that time period.
A lot of this, I think the correct word would be xenophobia, you know, fear of the and bigotry against the Chinese. I mean, the Chinese Exclusion Act didn't get repealed until 1943, and that was because suddenly the Japanese were seen as the enemies.
Well, yes, 43, because the Chinese were allies of with the United States, and the Chinese America in America then all of a sudden found itself in as comrade in arms, and unfortunately, we didn't see the Japanese in the same way.
Now, Pearl Harbor changed everything, didn't it? In that sense, yeah.
Well, absolutely for the Chinese, I would say that the World War II was a major, significant period for change of attitudes towards the Chinese of America, and the second. A very milestone, as I would put it, is the civil rights era that made giant leaps in changing attitudes toward the Chinese.
A lot of those attitudes had to do with labor competition, did they not?
Much of the labor competition, yes, we can, you know, focus on that as one of the major attitudes. But I actually think that basically, California or the West had an aversion of color population anyway, to begin with. For instance, in our very first California Constitution, the first item of business was to make sure that slave owners did not bring blacks into California.
That's right in the Constitution. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I'm talking to Philip Choi, whose new book is San Francisco Chinatown. He is a historian and architect, and it's a guide to the history and architecture of Chinatown. This was golden for many, Golden Mountain Chinatown. I mean, coming here and establishing roots in the United States. In many respects, even to this day, there's the argument that Chinatown is almost like an unassimilated foreign country. You can walk through parts of Chinatown, which, by the way, we should mention, despite all the tourist attractions, many San Franciscans know is quite poor and tenement-like and a lot of people suffering there, economic indignities of all kinds. But you walk through Chinatown and you might as well be in somewhere in Asia, somewhere in China. I mean, you hear no English spoken.
Well, the reason for that is because there is a continual influx of new immigrants. And, of course, they would gravitate to a place that's familiar with them. That is, the less affluent would gravitate towards the Chinatown itself. And that's pretty normal with all ethnic groups coming into the United States. But today, as you hear that, there's more than just Cantonese spoken in the area, because people from all over China and the rest of the world have gravitated toward Chinatown.
No, you hear Mandarin, you hear a lot of dialects and all sorts of varieties of Chinese. Do you ever think, you were born in Chinatown and you spent your life here in San Francisco, do you ever think you'd see what we see today, which is not only a Chinese-American mayor, but a figure like Rose Pak, who is probably one of the most powerful figures in San Francisco, Stephen Chu, Li Linyi. I mean, the political power of Chinese Americans is really preeminent.
Well, I would say that I didn't think I would ever see the day that that would happen, any more than I thought I would see a black president.
It's almost
in the
as unpredictable.
Absolutely. I think it's a great step forward. It's something that didn't think I would ever see happen.
Let's talk about some of the landmarks that you point out, the significant landmarks and sites in Chinatown. We hear from listeners, too. In fact, I want to put the question out to you about what some of your favorite sites in Chinatown and people's memories or experiences with Chinatown. In fact, let me do that now, because we'd like to hear from you and we'd like to hear your thoughts about particularly things that in Chinatown have made an impression on you, or experiences or memories you have that you want to bring to the fore here. Let me give the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now, and you can join us again by just dialing 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting, well, your memories, your questions, your comments about Chinatown, things particularly architecturally that have struck you, perhaps walking through Chinatown. I'd like to hear what those are. You can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. And the two things that I highlighted, Philip Choi, in talking about this program on the billboard were the playground, the Willy Woo Woo playground. And by the way, Willy Woo Woo Wong is now sort of identified in many people's minds, I suppose, with Jeremy Lin. I mean, he was this 5'6" sensational basketball player who played for the USF Dons. But not only a player, Julia Morgan, YWCA Residence Club, those are particularly preeminent in terms of architecture. What else?
Well, I would say that the Gordon Lau Elementary School is one of them. And if you trace back the history, it's very important. Most of the buildings that I single out, and unfortunately, tells us the social environment of the 19th century, or at the time the Chinese first appeared in San Francisco during the Gold Rush. And it tells us what the environment was like. It was very racist. And the school itself documents that. The very first school, for instance, was segregated, what they called the blacks and the Native Americans and the Chinese were segregated from public school. And later on, the Chinese were actually denied attending the public school. And so the school school after the earthquake was built in 1913 or 1914, and you can see that on the Washington Street side of, instead of the Gordon Lau, which is now on the Clay Street side.
So the school is one of your favorite sites?
I would say so, because it tells us the history of society of the time to the present day. I mean, from the very negative in terms of prohibiting Chinese from attending school to the present day, we have the school named after one of our former supervisor, Gordon Lau.
Well, in fact, now we're hearing Philip Choi's, and there are many places within Chinatown architecturally that he singles out. You may want to single out something that particularly, in your mind, needs to be singled out. I thought we'd bring John King into this discussion. John King is urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And John, good to have you aboard here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, when you think of architecture in China, what particularly comes to mind in Chinatown? Excuse me.
Well, what strikes me so much, and I think what strikes anyone who visits it, whether or not they really grasp it, is just the incredible density of it. I mean, it's so striking that you get the very thematic architecture at the Grant Avenue Gate, and some of the pagoda-like buildings along Grant, but really just the whole tight overlap of all these buildings jammed up against each other with no real clarity. It's such an incredibly dense, fun urban experience.
And what about what we were just talking about a moment ago with Philip Choi, how the building design actually changed after the earthquake, radical change, mainly with Anglo-American architects?
Well, it really did strike me. I've walked through. Hello, Philip, by the way.
Hi, good morning.
We've walked through, and it's just so fascinating, and this gets into the complexity of cities, which I think a lot of people tend to mix. It's fascinating that there is such a, again, almost thematic, I use the word oriental, because I think at the time there was almost that notion of, the mysterious Orient. And it was such a pragmatic, defensive move to keep the Chinese community in the center of the city rather than be sent off to the outskirts of town or something like that. And so you have, Anglo architects who are happy to be getting jobs after the earthquake, and you have landowners who want to pay them to do big, dramatic buildings. And so you had this almost instant landscape pop up, and it's just fascinating how the notion of cultural fusion and the notion of very kind of complex motives is not a new or a recent thing in American cities.
Well, John, I appreciate your perspective, and thank you so much for joining us. That's John King, by the way, who is urban design writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And we're talking about key sites and significant landmarks. What are they for you in Chinatown? Again, I'll ask the question. And Philip Choi, why not have a National Historic, why not make this a National Historic District? I guess property owners are the big problem, huh?
Well, I would say that it's more than just property owners. I think that the one of the problems of historic districting would be that the layers of bureaucracy involved in it, and Chinatown in itself, as I see it today, it's a vibrant area. I mean, it's constantly changing, it's constantly growing, and so on. So one needs to be aware of the different layers of bureaucracy that one would encumber. I mean, let's put it this way. I hate to see us trying to arrest Chinatown as a museum piece because it's constantly growing. And you have to allow it to grow.
Even as dense as it is, as we just heard from John King. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear from some of our listeners.
I would agree with Philip. I think there's a difference between kind of locking in certain height limits, certain size limits and things so that new buildings don't overwhelm what's there. That's a different thing than saying everything from now on has to pass a certain architectural muster, because I think part of what makes the experience so rich, and I really urge any listener who thinks, I haven't been to Chinatown in 20 years, I'm too cool for that, it's just a bunch of tourist shops on Grant, to go back and really walk along Stockton, walk along the alleys, go on the east-west streets. What makes it so rich is the real cacophony of different styles of neon signs next to carved wood, so on and so forth. There really is a jostle to the landscape that defines it more than any particular look, except for the very ornate set of buildings along Grant Avenue that are so dramatically Asian influence.
I like that phrase, jostle the landscape. Let me get Ron on here. Ron, go ahead.
Hi. You know, I've spent many very positive learning lunches with a man named Bill Tom. He was the head of the Tom family, since deceased. But we ate in various restaurants, including the restaurant in the building that he built in Chinatown with his family, with many buildings, where the Empress of China is. And I'm wondering if there is a focus on what the Tom family has contributed to the building culture of Chinatown. And he had various organizations which people from China came, new leaders that I was given an opportunity to meet with.
Sure.
But the principal opportunity was from the mentor himself, Bill Tom.
Yeah, Philip Choi, can you help us?
Sure. I know Bill, and I know of the Tom family, and I don't think it's any one person that contributed to the environment of Chinatown. I think that one building that they built was actually a very beginning of changing the environment of Chinatown. I remember that very vividly, and I don't quite remember the architects at the time, but I don't want to just single any one person as responsible for the environment of Chinatown.
Let me thank the caller. I want to get another caller on here and talking about the Chinese exodus. Good morning. Hi.
Good morning. This is Ross.
Yeah.
Thanks for the show. I live in Sacramento, and I know there's a city called Lac on the Sacramento River that was formed by Chinese back in, I think, the 1800s. There was a thriving Chinese community down by Old Sacramento, I think, in the rail yards, and they were run out of Sacramento. And I want to know if the exodus of the Chinese from Sacramento had an impact on San Francisco, or was there communication between Sacramento and San Francisco back when those bad days were occurring, and I just don't know about where the population went.
Philip Choi.
Well, actually, the Sacramento Chinatown survived, and I don't think there was the kind of riots that took place in Sacramento as it took place in throughout the Chinatowns in the West, and I'm talking about in the 19th century. I was responsible for the present exhibit at the Federal Courthouse, was the location of the very beginning of Chinatown itself. But the Sacramento Chinatown survived actually the hostility of the 18th, or rather the 19th century. And so to quickly answer you, the San Francisco population didn't increase because of the presence of the people from Sacramento.
And thank you, Ross, for that call. And John King, thank you. So good to have you aboard here.
Oh, my pleasure.
John King, again, is urban design writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll continue with Philip Choi. And with your questions or comments, feel free to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm going to continue talking about Chinatown, maybe find out a little bit about the tongs and all the weight watching and all of that when we return. Another side of Chinatown, maybe the darker side. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're focusing this hour on Chinatown, the oldest San Francisco ethnic neighborhood. Philip Choi grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown, went on to become an architect in the Bay Area, and has a new book out called San Francisco Chinatown, all about culture and history of the district and highlighting landmarks, as we said earlier, like the distinctive YWCA Residence Club, which was designed by Julia Morgan, famed architect, and the Willy Wong Playground, named after a former USF basketball star. And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite Chinatown building or historic site, and what memories particularly do you cherish or have about Chinatown? Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website. kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. We asked listeners on Facebook about their favorite Chinatown landmarks, and Matthew writes, the Y. Ed writes, Sam Woe's. And David writes, House of Nanking. Ronald says his favorite thing about Chinatown is dim sum, and Adam reminds us Oakland has a Chinatown, too. So of that handful of responses, at least three of them had to do with food. There is also a listener, Frank, who wrote on our website, my favorite landmark in Chinatown is the Goddess of Democracy statue. And a listener writes also on the website, I've always enjoyed Portsmouth Square, sitting in the sunshine in the slightly dirty park among the chatty card players and the Falun Gong, one of the few airy corners of the neighborhood, and it reminds me of a few parks I visited in Beijing. So you may have your own to add here. And in fact, as a caller said, there's not only a Chinatown in Oakland, but there are Chinatowns throughout the United States. We'll check in later with Bonnie Sue and talk with her about perhaps some of the differences in other Chinatowns throughout the United States. By the way, Philip Choi, I want to get to our callers or back to our callers here, but I said before we went to the break that maybe we could talk a bit about the Tong and the gangs. And I mean, there's all the way up to the Dragon Massacre in 1977. There's a whole trajectory of history there. They play a very central role, though, don't they?
Well, of course, I'm a little bit defensive in terms of the crime that takes place in Chinatown. I think that it's been overplayed.
It's like the mafia with Italians,
yeah. Right. But there's and my whole effort in writing the book is to kind of get away from a lot of that. And this is not to deny that it didn't exist. The Tong did exist once upon a time, and very notoriously control a lot of the vices and gambling, prostitution. And as a matter of fact, in early California, most of the Tong wars were fought over the possession of women and such. And so it lasted on throughout into the early decades of the 20th century.
And then you had the watching after that,
and for a very short period, if you were around at that time, so to speak. You would read how we, at the beginning of the civil rights period, Chinese were singled out as very, very noble citizens, and no crime existed, and so on. So what it is, the press kind of play a role in making the positive and negative and existence of Chinatown. And then for that one brief moment of how Chinese were such a well-behaved model citizens, then suddenly the watching and all that erupted in the 1950s.
So the stereotyping went to the other extreme.
Right, so all of a sudden it really came back, so to speak. So, you know, crime existed in any area, whether it's in Chinese or other ghetto areas. When you have poverty, that's what you have. And in the 50s, actually, as I recall it, a lot of young Chinese in Chinatown were just caught in that trap and nowhere to go. And so we have, again, the revival of criminal activities in Chinatown.
And we got, as I alluded to, a lot of newspaper headlines with the Dragon Massacre back in 77. And that was mainly, I think, watching gangs again. Let me bring more of... Oh, you can tell me about the origin of chop suey?
Oh, well, the origin of chop suey, actually many, many legends have been fabricated since and added to and so on. And it was a fact that a Chinese official named Lei Hongjiang, who came visited and resided for a short period in Washington D.C. as a diplomat, and one of the legends stemmed from that he craved Chinese food, and sent the chef out to cook him up some Chinese food in the middle of the night or something like that. And now I'm adding to the legend. But anyway.
A lot of Chinese food has American birth to it, as opposed to being from China. I mean, what we think of is
it's absolutely not a Chinese or original Chinese food, and concocted really in Chinese America, you might say, but.
Like the architecture.
Yeah. Well, I would say that with a parallel.
Let me bring more of our callers on, and we go to Michelle next. Michelle, hi.
Hi, morning. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Sure.
I have two comments and a question. Two comments are two things that struck me as a kid. My dad's been practicing in Chinatown since the 70s, and I always followed him when I was little through all the many alleyways like Ross and Waverly. And in addition to that, the markets were, they were kind of like a cave, like the fish markets. You would go in and you would pick a live fish and, you know, they would cut it for you right there. And
actually, excuse me, but Amy Tan, who grew up in Oakland, has stories that take place on Waverly.
Really?
Yeah, young girls growing up in Chinatown, all that, yeah.
That's cool. I'll have to check that out. A question I have is about those alleyways, and I was told since I was little that they were built because since Chinatown was such an enclosed area and the Chinese were not allowed to spread out within San Francisco, they had to expand within, and that's where the alleyways came from. And I just wanted to confirm whether or not that's just something I heard randomly or that's actually has some truth to it.
Philip Choi.
Yeah. Well, you have to remember that the Chinese occupy an existing area. In other words, what we occupy was the former birthplace of San Francisco. So all the alleyways existed and was already designed and in place when the Chinese took over. So yes, it's true that Chinese, lived in very crowded conditions, and the fact that they were not able to expand beyond certain invisible borders, which then kept Chinatown in these crowded conditions.
And I thank you, Michelle, and let me bring some more of our callers on. JL, good morning. You're on forum.
Hi, Mr. Krasny. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just want to mention my favorite landmark in Chinatown is the Hilton Hotel, which used to be the Holiday Inn, because that's where Dirty Harry, the intro scene for it, was filmed.
He's talking about the hotel where Dirty Harry was filmed. That is,
and what about that? I mean, what was the question?
That's his favorite landmark.
Not my favorite.
No, I wouldn't think so.
I don't fantasize any landmark on basis of Hollywood.
Okay.
Well, thanks, though, for the call, JL. But a lot of these pagodas and outer facades that we see in Chinatown come from Hollywood, at least from a kind of Hollywood imagination. Mm. Yeah. Heidi wants to know, what did Chinatown look like before the earthquake?
Oh, very, very simply, it's actually a part of old San Francisco. All of the architecture itself was typically Victorian, and was abandoned to the Chinese. And when the Chinese took over Chinatown, the only way you can identify it as Chinatown is a lot of Chinese people living in it. And also the signboards in the stores, they were written in Chinese calligraphy and identified by the food stuff sold. And other than that, the Chinese, of course, decorated the balconies, which were fire escapes, and put out large lanterns. And as a matter of fact, visitors to Chinatown at the time complained that they didn't see any pagodas.
Now, there was a lot of tea and ginseng and churches in those early years, right?
Not churches so much at the time. That, and we're talking about pre-quake, right? Not the churches developed, or they were missions, actually, a lot of missions. Yeah. And that to me was another very important part of Chinatown, because we do see all the churches today in Chinatown, all the denominations. And in fact, when I'm talking with people, they would ask you, gee, the Chinese are very religious people, lot of Christians. I said, no, yes, true, yes, but how did it all begin? It began actually during the gold rush. And that's another important fact that people don't know about. Actually, the churches didn't just start in Gold Rush, San Francisco, but actually came by way of China. Missionaries were already, prior to the earthquake, were sent to China to Christianize some 300 million Chinese. And this was a period we call the Second Awakening. But when gold was discovered, the missionaries thought, aha, it's better to Christianize the Chinese here and send them back to China. And that's how the churches all sprung up.
Let me bring another caller on. And that's Anna joining us from up in Seattle. Welcome, Anna.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for taking my call. In 1992, I spent about 6 months living at 123 Waverly Street in San Francisco, and it was just one of my most favorite parts of my life. I lived at the very top floor of 123 Waverly, which is kind of an alley, and I actually was there when they were filming the Joy Luck Club, which was I was just walking home one day and noticing all these Dodge Darts on the street and these people dressed kind of mod, and I thought, wow, this is so strange. And then I turned the corner just to get into my house, and there was the film crew and all these actors and filming, you know, on my street. It was just an amazing experience. I loved coming home at night and hearing the swish of the Mahjong tiles. I loved the smell of the street. I lived in a building that had a little store at the bottom, and then a Mahjong parlor underneath me, and then a temple, and then our little apartment was in the back, and then in the front was the Chinese People's Workers Association, which had language classes for recent immigrants. It was pretty great.
Well, you have evoked a lot of memories there, and I like the detail of the way you present those. Thank you. In fact, we're asking listeners to evoke memories of Chinatown, and I think some more from Dill. Hi, Dill.
Michael, good morning for him. Chinese Lunar New Year is just around a couple of weeks away, and the celebrations begin. And one of my memories younger was the parade going actually up and over on Grant Street, and the explosions of the firecrackers in the air above our heads, and the gallantry and the excitement was something that I remember still because of the program today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. In fact, so we're talking about memories of Chinatown. I can remember when there was some controversy in Chinatown because some of the stores started bringing in the early 70s when I started living in the Bay Area, Maoist type of fashions. And so people from Taiwan were not happy about that. There was really, you know, there still is that schism within the Chinese community here in Chinatown. But you got a lot of people asking about the underground tunnels. Let me go to you on this, Philip Choi. Let me just read from our website. Rice says, when studying at San Francisco State, I heard there were possibly underground tunnels running beneath Chinatown. Is that true, and are they accessible? And Brian says, is the legendary underground tunnels and secret chambers? What can your guests tell us about these subterranean features, and what is the likelihood that the Muni extension to North Beach will uncover some of them?
Well, this is, you know, it'll take too long to tell you. Maybe you can read the book. In the preface, I talked about the tunnels.
Yes, you did.
But anyway, I mean, legends die hard, especially...
urban legends, especially.
Yeah, right, right. And I've been through some of the Chinatown areas, but what you see... Is even three stories of basement, that's a possibility. And there are times when the buildings were, underground were connected. I mean, there wasn't the property line division. For instance, even on Kearney Street, the under the sidewalk, you can walk along from one whole block under the sidewalk. So these are the things that led to the legends of underground tunnel. But in the 19th century, when Chinatown was a tourist site, just as it is today, but for different reasons. People came to see the obscene and the evils of Chinatown, and so the tunnels were concocted, actually, by the tour guides, because you had to follow the licensed tour guides at the time to go through Chinatown if you think your to value your life. So the press made it that way. So after the earthquake, actually, the police department that reprimanded the tour guides that if they were to be licensed at all, they have to refrain from all the sensationalization of Chinatown.
Well, it was sensational, and it just helped exacerbate that whole image of the sinister underground world of the Chinese.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's a listener, Paul, who writes, "I don't have a favorite place in Chinatown. I like the overall ambiance, especially the side streets and alleyways. I do wish that the gaudy glass shops that are at the Bush Street end would go away. I'm pleased to see that several buildings have recently been painted, some rather brightly. I also appreciate hearing Chinese musicians singing in small groups playing Chinese music on Chinese instruments. Having traveled a bit in recent years, I'm somewhat surprised to see how complete a district our Chinatown is compared to those in other of the world's major cities. I hope they can keep the best of what is as we move forward. I, too, would not like to see Chinatown become an amusement park or museum, but they should not consider what is torn down carefully, because it shouldn't become just another mall either, and too many shops there are already taking on that look." Well, we thought we'd bring on Bonnie Tsui, who is no stranger to Forum. In fact, she's been on in the past, and we're glad to have her join this conversation. She's the author of American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods, and also a frequent contributor to the New York Times, and former editor, Travel and Leisure. And welcome, Bonnie.
Thanks, Michael. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Bonnie.
Phil and I know each other well.
I figure you must. And what you also know well, of course, are the other Chinatowns. And I'm interested to hear kind of you give us the picture of the differences of this Chinatown. What makes it unique and how it compares architecturally?
Well, you know, as I've been listening to this morning's program, I've been struck by some of the questions that, people have been asking about the architecture, about San Francisco specifically, of course, San Francisco being so historic and so, I guess the primacy of San Francisco's Chinatown in people's minds is no accident, right, because it's been around for so long. But a lot of what holds true for the creation of that Chinatown, it can be seen in the newest Chinatowns, in Las Vegas, for example. And one of the things that I found when I was researching my book is that there are a lot of parallels. There are a lot of parallels between, you never would have thought, between Las Vegas Chinatown and San Francisco Chinatown in the creation of the architecture and the story behind why is it that Chinatown is built to look the way it does. And of course, off the Las Vegas Strip, that community that has grown up, it grew up and looks the way it does with the same sort of pagoda roof lines and things because to serve as a tourist attraction. In many ways, many ways, like the way that the people after the quake here in San Francisco wanted to attract the mainstream audience to
Las Vegas, wanting to attract tourists. Are you sure?
but to that community, of course. And so the reasons for building the way they've done is it holds true over the decades, over the centuries.
It's not only Las Vegas, though. I mean, this was a kind of paradigm for many other Chinatowns that burgeoned because it was successful in drawing tourists to San Francisco.
That's right.
So we do see kind of these miniature and often little quasi-clonish versions of San Francisco.
That's right, and that's actually a good way to put it. And when you were talking about this sort of Hollywood look, or sort of that it's pop culture influence, right? It kind of, and I think mushrooming is not a bad word to use because they are facsimiles, that have kind of popped up over the years. And one is a copy of the previous, but if you trace everything back to San Francisco, there is a direct line when you talk about that. The reasons that things happened. And I think that whole line of history is exactly what Phil talks about in his book, and that's what's so fascinating about it. There is a root to that.
And you can stay with us, Bonnie, through the rest of the hour? Great. Bonnie Tsui again, travel writer and author of American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods. More of your calls. Andy, hi.
Hi. I'd like to point out that one really interesting aspect of Chinatown is that it contains a really distilled and excellent collection of traditional Chinese history that you really can't find in places overseas. I have a lot of experience living in Asia and in China, and I speak and read Chinese. And what I've found in Chinatown is some excellent store. Like when you come out of the Broadway tunnel, the Tai Yik store immediately on your left there at Powell is an example of a place where you can find a lot of great traditional Chinese folklore that I never found in one place when I lived in Hong Kong and Singapore and traveled in China for years.
Yeah, thank you for that perspective, Andy, and I appreciate hearing from you. In fact, those of you who are interested in Chinatown, I mentioned before Felicia Lowe's film, which I believe at least part of it may be available even on YouTube, but Peter Stein, formerly of KQED, also did a series on neighborhoods, which included a film about Chinatown, and there's some, got Bonnie's book, you've got Philip's book. There's really good stuff to learn a great deal about Chinatown. And we're learning from you, our listeners. Let's go to more of you. Robert, join us. Hi.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. An interesting mythological incident to add to Chinatown is that in 1977, after the Golden Dragon incident, the U.S. Army formed a set of the Honor Guard, the combat engineers, over at the 864th on the Presidio, and had us go for a tour, which was hosted by the sheriff of Chinatown. They took us for 2 days through the entire town, showed us all the alleyways, all the major doorways, all the locations you could go from building to building, and then just apparently made a presence because a few months later we all went in uniform and did the same thing. I believe that what that was the U.S. Army telling whoever it was in Chinatown that the use of automatic weapons is proscripted, and we were just simply showing flexing muscle to let them know that we have bigger and better weapons. I believe the Army was afraid at that point because of the automatic weapon use, and I believe they used this as a method to show our power.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that memory. And I want to get Penny on, who's calling us from Chinatown in Sacramento. Penny, welcome.
Hi, and hi, Philip.
Good morning.
Nice to hear your voice again on the radio. And I want to say that I believe that you, Philip, should be honored as a national treasure because you've given so much to all of the Chinese communities, history and cultural-wise, throughout California. And I'm honored to be in Yifao, Sacramento's Chinatown. I wanted to say something about some of the architecture that's in some of the buildings in San Francisco and also here in Sacramento, how some on the corners, how the building roof line will kind of curve up. Now, I believe, and I'd like to know from you whether or not I'm correct on this, that came probably more from southern China, and the fact of that would have been for actually going back to feng shui and keeping the negativity, because of the sharp corners, edges are thought to bring about sha qi, and that as they flow up, then that deflects the negative qi or energy. What would you say to that, Philip?
Well, I think that the architecture that was identified and perceived in the United States basically is just the imagination of the person and exposure to what they think of, thought of as Chinese architecture. And most of the architecture with the curve and eaves and so on, perhaps you're right. I'm not a student of the mythology of Chinese architecture and so on, but you would say that that's found throughout China anyway, and that type of architecture actually began way back in the Song Dynasty and then continue. And actually, Chinese architecture in itself was pretty much arrested for a long time and until it more recently caught up with the West.
Let me thank Penny for the call. Let me go back to you, Bonnie Soy. Are there Chinatowns that at least try to follow more prescriptively the architecture of China, or at least have more of that than other Chinatowns?
I think that the vast majority of the leanings architecturally were probably for the look and less the
less authenticity, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps not the original. You know, a lot of of course, as Phil said, that this architecture traces back to China, certainly, but because it's been filtered through all these lenses here in the United States, that it's all become its own thing. You know, it's a Chinese American thing, and so I would say. Even in Los Angeles, when Chinatown there and its various incarnations was rebuilt over and over again, and every time there were, in the beginning, it didn't really buildings didn't resemble Chinese buildings as we think of them. They were whatever buildings that were there at the time, and the previous tenants moved out to more, better neighborhoods, and then the Chinese moved in, and that's sort of how it has been in a lot of these urban Chinatowns. And so the orientalization of the architecture happened over time, and again, a lot, oftentimes as a response to the outside world, to make itself more palatable, and that is a different thing entirely.
Well, let me extend thanks to you, Bonnie Soy, for joining us, and to Philip Choi, and also to John King, who also joined us during the hour. To you, our listeners, just want to get one more email in here. Carrie from Oakland says, one of the best parts of Chinatown is a little store in one of the alleys where you can see fortune cookies being made. We're getting all kinds of responses, wide range of them. Thank you for those. Thank you for listening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.